Welcome, Max, to the Seize and Assist podcast. Thank you very much for joining us, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Aidan. It's a pleasure to be on here.
Pleasure to always speak to you. We have been on a number of panels around the world. We've been on different, the intersection of regular law enforcement versus the proper crypto technology sort of discussions. And it would be good to sort of really dive in today with sort of the theme of the Seize and Assist podcast is to unpack a lot of the complicated topics, put them in plain English, and also contextualize them to the asset recovery audience. Now, why does this matter to a civil tax inspector? Why does this matter to a criminal investigator? Why does this matter to a prosecutor? So I think to set the stage, even though I'm pretty convinced everybody knows you from LinkedIn, you're more famous than me. Would you give us a bio, please, and let us know what got you to the pinnacle of your career, which is appearing on this podcast?
That's a great pinnacle, by the way. So I can retire tomorrow. So
achieved it all.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm Max Berndt. I'm born and raised from Austria. So I'm actually from Vienna. I studied law here, did a PhD focusing on transnational collaboration, a fight against organized crime, corruption, money laundering, and joint degree between Australia and Austria. So I saw both the Austria with kangaroos and the ones without. So really focusing on transnational collaboration, the work the UNODC, Interpol, FATF, and other standard setting bodies are doing in this regard. So really ensuring how can law enforcement bodies best collaborate across borders and ultimately effectively prosecute criminal behavior, right? So I worked as a criminal defense attorney, so really down to this road again for 6 years in Vienna, having a law firm here, mostly focusing on organized crime and drug trafficking, etc. And then Bitcoin popped up 2015-16 for the first time in my own practical experience and also from a theory side, because we were writing on a report about trafficking in human beings in Southeast Asia, and Bitcoin popped up as a means of payment. So looking into it also from a criminal law perspective, so to say. Published a lot of stuff on that, and then got more into crypto, made this my main field of work, so to say. Joined a startup that I scaled as chief legal officer for 2.5 years. And then end of 2023, start of 2024, I joined TaxBit as their international managing director and global head of regulatory affairs. So really working very, very closely with our government sector line, so to say. I'm currently co-chairing the business advisory group at the OECD negotiations on the crypto asset reporting framework that I will elaborate a bit more in this podcast. And yeah, like you said, Aidan, lots of traveling, lots of discussions, lots of work that has to be done. And although the name TaxBit may not suggest it, we are very deeply involved into financial crime investigations, coming from a very strong background of tax investigation work we've done with the Internal Revenue Service of the United States for the past 4.5-5 years now. So really, really looking forward to the discussion today. Thanks for having me.
No, listen, thank you. Like I say, I think the two of us sort of rank up our miles sort of galore. So it's nice to, I think we're both sitting at home, respectively. So that's
or once
first thing. I wanted to start at the end. Then, for those that don't know, I mean, it's the asset recovery ecosystem is confusing, let alone digital asset recovery ecosystem. So when someone can think about digital forensics as the Cellebrites, the Magnets, the Cat Labs, most people on the show will know the analytic companies, the Chainalysis, Elliptics, TRMs of the world, for example, and Merkle's, and I think there's over 20 companies now, and Crystal and God, so many. And again, I always selfishly, when I think about asset reality, think of them as if they're the metal detector or the investigator or the track and trace tool, to dumb it down. We're the shovel, we're the tow truck, we're that piece that leads the seizure, and then whether it needs managed or custody reported, we sort of we talk a lot obviously about our role As you said, TaxBit probably slightly misleads people into what it is, the breadth of what you guys do. But again, part of our mission, I also should say, we're very proud of the fact that we don't do pay to play. This isn't a sponsored TaxBit thing. Every single person who's ever on the show is a person who just has worked in the industry and talks about what they do, with the mission being, as a practitioner, you can then say, oh, I understand what they do. I heard that guy, Max, talking about it. I understand now. I mean, this is all educational. There is no sponsorships or anything like that. So for that reason, I mean, what if I'm an asset recovery practitioner and I've used an analytic tool, maybe I'm serving a freezing order on an exchange, or I'm seizing assets, or I'm managing assets, and we'll get into the EU policies and those really big forcing factors that are changing things, just in terms of a tool, software, services basis, what does TaxBit do through the eyes of an asset recovery practitioner? And when might they, you mentioned like IRS and others, when would people normally be utilizing your services, just to know where you fit in on the ecosystem?
Very good question. Thanks, Aiden. Maybe when you pointed it out already, when you describe asset reality as the shovel in the whole investigation process, I would call TaxBit the bridge, being more the bridge between on and off chain data. So maybe to give some background on this, for the last years, ever since 2015, 2016, mostly, a lot of law enforcement bodies around the world have been using blockchain analytics tools. Like you said, Aiden, and there's been quite a lot of players around providing these very, very highly sophisticated services, right? Because it needs to be state of the art, because criminals are always advancing. So also these blockchain analytics tools need to develop. But I give you a very simple example. You are a police officer using one of these great analytic tools, and you figure out the flow of illicit funds along on chain, right? From wallet to wallet to wallet to wallet. In most cases, what you would see is that at one point, the flow of funds hits an exchange, hits a broker, right? A crypto asset service provider, as we call them, or virtual asset service provider. And then everything that happened next is still a gray box. It's a black box, right? Because it happens what we call off-chain. So when we talk about off-chain, what we really mean is internal transaction ledgers of exchanges or crypto asset service providers. So everything that I do on either an omnibus wallet of an exchange, what I do internally within the exchange, cannot be followed if you use a blockchain analytics tool, right?
Just like a bank, once it hits a traditional bank, you don't get to trace it through as a practitioner.
Bingo. And that's exactly where we come into play. So basically what we are seeing is police officer would then subpoena information from a large crypto service provider or even from two or three sources, right? Because often these funds hit multiple exchanges and then receive CSVs or Excel sheets with often hundreds of thousands of rows, with often very different formats. Even if you subpoena information from one service provider, it can look one way the one week and completely different the other week. So we have this ever-changing format issue of like how to then ingest this data and merge it with the on-chain activity. So once I've subpoenaed information from the crypto asset service provider, the question really becomes, how can I, as an investigation body, continue my investigations? And this is really down to merging transactions across on and off chain. So everything that I identified on chain, that I match these transactions with the off chain transactions, so the transactions on the exchange, to be able to follow the money. Because ultimately, you want to know the flow of the illicit funds. And what we mostly see is that most criminals are actually using exchanges in a way that you would transact the same way as, for example, with mixing services on chain. So what we are seeing really is that ultimately the transaction behavior on exchanges is often hundreds of thousands of transactions, right? And so you receive a CSV or an Excel sheet from an exchange and have more than 100,000 rows, or like even a million rows. And what we're seeing is Excel, for example, caps out at 1 million rows, right? So how, as an investigation body, can you actually prosecute that and look at it and actually ingest all the data and merge it? And then, after all, the goal here is to see, okay, do I need to do anything further in this investigation, or do I have all the data that I need, or are there any data gaps that would require further investigations? For example, outgoing transactions to other exchanges where I need to subpoena information from. You have outgoing transactions to self-hosted wallets, so to my own wallet as a criminal or like to other sources, where then there's a further on-chain activity that needs to be further investigated with a blockchain analytics tool. And so basically, this is where we as TaxBit come in and bridge the gap. We take all the data that was collected through blockchain analytic tools, all the on-chain activity, and connect it with the internal transaction ledgers of the exchanges, merge all the data streams, and identify these data gaps, help you to basically reconcile data, bring it into a readable format, like across all these transactions, identify either new on-chain leads or say, okay, because these new on-chain leads or like even leads to another exchange don't go beyond a certain significant threshold, help me as an investigation body to decide, do I need to take further steps? And where this brings us is really TaxBit working as a data aggregation tool. So we are data aggregator for on and off-chain data. And what we can also ingest, and this is where it becomes really interesting, is also the classical fiat side. Because basically what we are seeing is that also if you subpoena information from a bank, they would deliver the information in a similar format, like, for example, crypto service provider, right, in a CSV or Excel sheet. So we merge all of these transactions, even in an outgoing payments with fiat to crypto, or even all of the fiat transactions. And for example, if on the bank statement, it becomes obvious that an individual used other crypto exchanges because he paid, like he had an on-ramp, for example, on another exchange where he transferred $10,000 to, then this is probably also a source where I should subpoena information regarding this individual. So we are bridging the gap between these on and off-chain data sets, bringing all the transaction together in one aggregated format, helping identify gaps, adding pricing and valuation for assets, like across on-chain activities. This is a very, very important point, right? And here, this is a question of being very, very precise, because often these thresholds are either very, very important for the amount of, like the significance of a criminal case, right? Has this person ever profited from any of the stuff they were doing, for example? So we help to really put everything into one single case management tool, I would say, that helps you to track across on and off chain sources.
It's fascinating, and every time we talk about this, I end up getting a little bit more confused in a good way, in the sense of my brain spins, because I sort of think, would it be right as someone that's been an investigator and as someone that's been a civil tax investigator, but in a criminal investigation directorate, which meant you were getting those large pieces of data and like this pre-blockchain. Now, one of the big challenges was, you've got your money laundering, there's so many potential tasks you have to do. And it sounds to me, to put it in layman's terms for those listening, I mean, it's thinking about, well, a civil tax inspector might be interested in, I'll take it back a step. We're also familiar with bank statements and how banking transactions work. If we apply that logic to digital assets, it's too big and too complicated to just make those same assumptions. What you're saying is, as all of this stuff is moving around, there's times that it is moving around and changing hands. And if it's changing hands, in which case then there's potentially a money laundering offense there. But what was the value? How do you work out the value on these millions of lines of data, for example? It's not like watching $1 move from here to here. It's 0.00 of a ETH, for example. So when you start to just compound all of that, but then if I'm a civil tax investigator, I'm wanting to potentially explore, was there a gain? Was there a chargeable event where actually someone has bought it for X, sold it for Y, for example? But then likewise, I might be investigating an international money laundering racket. And all of a sudden, I go in, use the analytic tool, I get some information from the exchange, pair that together. And the output for me is, you need to go and speak to those other three exchanges because they might have information as well. But I've now built my case a bit more from, do you remember I thought it was one guy and four accounts? It's now 35 guys and 2 million accounts, but I have to still go and build more. So yeah, so I like that data aggregation and that sort of bridge analogy. what for you, to put it into a practical case study, I mean, what do you see users, like, what does good look like? What is, when you think that's a great, like, customer success story? Because I know that from a crude analytics perspective, following the money, finding it at an exchange and grabbing it. I mean, the tool companies can sort of high five and be like, amazing, we made that easier. Like the welcome to video case, tracing the Bitcoin around the internet, successfully dismantling this, you know, horrific organization that was selling child pornography and child exploitation material. But because they were using Bitcoin, they were able to trace them, find them everywhere. And then that results in, and that, for me, on and off chain, when I think about it in an analogs perspective, it's, you know, on-chain data leading to off-chain kicking in a door, grabbing someone and finding the identity behind the blockchain. What does it look like now with the advent of tools like, you know, your data aggregation layer? But what does a modern investigation using your tool look like?
Okay, very, very good question. So many, many, many points here I want to quickly elaborate on.
I'm a terrible interviewer, by the way.
It's amazing. Okay. No, it's to make it very simple. I think one of the biggest pluses that we help law enforcement, police, financial crime units, or tax departments, right? Because that can be used. The whole data aggregation aspect is significant on both sides: financial crime, on taxation in particular. Because always here, it's very, very important to have like a complete data set, right? To see, okay, are there any gains and losses? Because one single transaction can make the difference, right? So basically, this help, like, for the, when it comes down to ICP, the ideal customer profile, I think for us, we are servicing all kinds of investigation authorities. That's the first piece. From a user journey perspective, the most difficult thing for most enforcement bodies right now is harmonizing off-chain data sources. So really, if they subpoena information from three different exchanges, how to bring all of these transactions together without manually working for weeks and weeks to trying to bring this data together. So this is where I think at the moment, and this is a really, it's a very sophisticated step, of course, but it sounds very simple. It's really just bringing together this disparate data sources. That's the first thing. If I can give you, for example, a case that we were working on, a case study, so to say, it was interestingly enough for a law investigation case, but more from the private sector side. But something that we received, like our client came to us with a potential fraud case, and they knew it was incomplete data, but it was highly complex. They basically gave us 20 CSV documents from accounts that they had received from a very, very large exchange, the largest in the world. And basically, all of these CSV accounts amounted to 400,000 transactions. And the case was about an individual that collected money from investors, saying that he traded on this platform, making money, right? Making money over time. So he collected millions and millions. So basically, in this case, it was 10 million plus that he collected from several investors saying, "Hi, I'm Max, I'm the superstar trader, and I'm making money for you. So invest into me, and I'm doing that for on your behalf," right? And now the question came when ultimately the case dropped was, did this individual, while they were raising money, were they really profitable? Or was it a case where you say, okay, this person was profitable all the time, but at some point the volatility hit that they just lost all the money, so it's not really a criminal liability here, right? Probably from a civil perspective, but on the criminal side, maybe they didn't have the intention to fraud the people. So it was really to get, and these transactions were happening over a span of 2 years, right? So it was highly complex across multiple accounts. And so basically what we saw is we ingested these 400. So what the client said to us is, if they would work on the case themselves, they would spend like 6 weeks even trying to reconcile and match the data across these 10 different accounts from this large exchange and these 400,000 transactions. We ingested this, and within half an hour, we were able to say, hey, XYZ data points are missing. You need to subpoena further information from the crypto asset service provider. They got back to this service provider, received another data set. And again, in this new data set, futures were missing, right? So another set of data was missing, and we were helping them to identify these data points. And think about the manual efforts that are necessary to go through all of these Excel sheets and even like figure out what is missing in the data, right? So we help, yeah. Like this is where we really solve a big, big pain point, is identifying these data gaps. And ultimately they came back to us with CSVs and data sets of like 1.4 million transactions across this service provider. And we were basically helping to solve this case for this investigation authority that otherwise would have never been able to be solved. So this is on the individual case work. Do you have any questions there? Otherwise, I would also quickly touch on like the other part, other piece. The other piece that we are seeing right now is that a lot of the investigation authorities are sending what's called in the United States a John Doe summons to exchanges, or like a bulk data information request to an exchange in order to receive data about their users. Also, that can be either in one single CSV or Excel with millions of data rows, or it's split per customer and you receive like 50,000 Excels or CSVs about these individuals, right?
And it's worth interjecting there, Max, that I mean, this is something that's been around for decades. Now, John Doe summons isn't specific to crypto. It's me going to a exactly. large institution saying, I have a lawful reason to inquire about X customers that you have that do Y. So I could be a manufacturing company and I want to know who you've been, you know, sending chemicals that could be used in narcotics production. Or similarly, I could say, I think you're a financial institution and I want to know about these customers with these holdings. So again, I think some people keep hearing John Doe summons in relation to, you know, exchanges, thinking it's a crypto thing. But again, it brings up the, what do you do with all the data when you get it back?
Exactly. It's really about bulk data assessments. So basically what we have built, especially when it comes down to crypto, this gets highly complex because of the transaction volumes for each and every user across these platforms, right? And what we have built is really a tool that helps you to ingest all of these data sets that you receive from an exchange and filter out, for example, the top 200 trading accounts. Because this is ultimately where it comes down to efficiency. No government body in the world will be able to go through all of these 15,000 cases, 20,000 cases, 50,000 cases, right? But it's really about narrowing down which are the cases we should look at based on which parameters, right? It can be, for example, that we say, okay, we flag something as risky because of the amount of transactions. We flag something as risky because of the assets that were being used on that platform, right? Maybe they had privacy coins that were used on that platform. Or maybe it's because, and this is in most cases the case, they had a lot of money coming in and a lot of money going out. So there, and they, for example, and this is what brings us back to the whole tax thing, never declared on taxes, right? So they never had made any gains from an official point of view. And if we then, and this bridges the gap, so to say, again, also to the whole seizure question, because if we look at TradFi, the number one reason for seizures still remains tax evasion or tax fraud, right?
You are pretty converted. As someone that worked in a team, our whole thing was the Al Capone effect. I mean,
yes.
This is why what I'm so enthusiastic about asset recovery and with the potentials of digital assets, because if you look at and the impact digital assets has on asset recovery, and that's why we do this show, we don't want people to say, I don't do crypto, or we haven't got into digital assets yet. It's like you have a seemingly perfect landscape where you have now, you know, all of these offenses taking place. So even if you can't get your Lazarus group, you know, North Korean sort of DPRK missile development sort of style offenses, you will still have, you know, wholesale tax evasion. And if you look at the data, you have irrefutable data that it might be used to go after the Mr. Big that you can't pin the offense on, but because he has crypto, you can get him on the tax offense. To similarly, you can get those people that are blatantly making millions, if not billions, and not declaring it. So it's almost like there's two directions of travel from the asset recovery piece. But as you've sort of perfectly sort of summarized, the issue with probably digital assets is just the scale of information. Again, I liken it to, I mean, there's a reason we use digital forensics tools. There's a reason we use blockchain analytic tools. There's a reason why people use our platform to manage lots and lots of assets. If you do anything manually, it will take longer. And I think especially in asset recovery, and especially criminal cases, even civil recovery cases involving insolvency practitioners, I mean, there's so much that can go wrong that can blow up your own case that if you make an assumption, and as you say, haven't identified a gap, you end up wrecking your own freezing order, you end up wrecking your own case, or worst case scenario, as all investigators have been involved in, build a case, work on it for years, and someone says, we're not taking it forward. Because you haven't connected, there's too many assumptions. So I think I'm so confident and happy that, you know, hopefully people listening will see that this isn't a new thing. I remember one of the first times I'd used, there's a British company called Altair, the first time using their tool that took PDF printed out bank statements, feed them through their scanner, and it spits out a lovely spreadsheet. And like, yeah, we used to have a typing pool, an admin team that would just sit and type in PDFs all day to create Excel spreadsheets. And this sounds to me like, you know, just the compounding iterations of the technology, like I2 charts for like exploding lots of data across a screen. That would it be fair to say that it takes all of that data and allows you then, in the simplest terms, like what I2 charts did for analysis, like what blockchain analytics is doing for investigation, you're basically solving that problem of there's just a lot of data. And you can either get this wrong, miss leads, miss asset recovery opportunities, also wreck your own case. And I think the bit we're going to touch on next is how much are we leaving on the table that could be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of tax evasion cases.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to get everybody in the end with digital assets. Whether you're a president, politician, civil servant, someone somewhere has not paid the tax on the digital assets their friends told them to invest in a couple of years ago.
Yeah, Aidan, and the numbers are quite mind-blowing, I must say. So absolutely right. So basically, after all, it's nothing new. What we have built is really a tool that helps to increase efficiency with workflows, right? It helps you to narrow down the cases that require these very, very specific investigation works. Because I think right now it's often like investigations would only be conducted in a very extensive way if something is linked to a very shady wallet. Let's say it's not even like every single illicit behavior, but it's like the truly illicit behavior, right? And so right now it's really about, okay, how can we increase efficiency in cases? There's all these stellar tools in blockchain analytics that help you to find these criminal cases. But the question now becomes, okay, how can we improve efficiency? Yeah, so what we are seeing—
How can you work the case?
Exactly. And I mean, what people often overlook is people rely way too much on artificial intelligence, right? Because all the blockchain analytic tool providers are now venturing into artificial intelligence to basically sum up all the data that is gathered on chain and put it in a more readable format so that you can have it structured and actually look at it and say, okay, this is something that requires further work. This is where the case is closed and this is where I can take it to court, right? Three decisions, very simple. The problem is this applies to on-chain because on-chain is an open book. It's a transparent. It's very, very transparent what happens on-chain. Everyone can look into it. It's not really linked to GDPR. However, when we talk about off-chain data and everything that comes with subpoenaed information from an exchange, we are in a completely different area, right?
Where
you cannot use artificial intelligence to work through this highly sensitive data. That's a very, very big problem, right? And this is also where I feel, yes, what we are doing is not new, but we are the first mover in a space that has really established a government solution that has been successfully tested with a very large body and helps you to comply with all the requirements that you as an authority have to comply with. Because otherwise, I can just throw a lot of data into any online tool and say, okay, hey, this is where I get results from. But the problem is, after all, these are highly protected data, especially if it's subpoenaed information.
Yeah, and I think that people listening to this who have no digital asset experience will, like people will unanimously agree there's plenty of cases out there. like we do. I'm not saying we shouldn't build more cases and we shouldn't always look for ways to develop more intelligence on the front end. If we think of that as like the top of the funnel, but anyone who's ever been in law enforcement or financial intelligence will be like, we have enough SARs and STRs to work on. The problem is we can't profile them or weed them. Or the problem is you're in a small island jurisdiction where you've got two people receiving 20,000 SARs a month. Or you've got a large jurisdiction like the UK or the US where there's so much going in. The actual profiling and getting those down to the right teams at the right time to act on them. I mean, we have countless coalitions of TradFi and law enforcement and blockchain and law enforcement. So the top of the funnel is pretty well stacked, I think it is right now, that we're starting to get into. I mean, the UK is a good example. The UK seizes, I think the last stats were about 800 million frozen, and that results in about 250, 300 million actually seized or confiscated. So of course, it would be a really useful thing to look at and say, well, how can we make that 250 more effective and drive up that 250 closer to the 8? But we can also in tandem say, well, what if the 8 was a billion and not 800 million? Then if your hit rate moves even a tiny percentage, you can compound and just see bigger returns in asset recovery. But the bit that I'm really keen to get your thoughts on, because you've talked about the tooling, we've talked about the collection and the aggregation of data to understand things, to make it more efficient. Now, the other sort of elephant in the room, as you said, is that I love calling crypto the Wild West for all of the right reasons, innovation, get things wrong. It's it can all go horribly wrong, but it's a bit frontiering. Where it's absolutely not the Wild West is the EU when it comes to very clear restrictions, policies, guidance, regulatory frameworks. We've just seen the new announcement and talk about stable coins. Some of these big exchanges not even trying to register in Europe because it's too difficult, lack of regulatory clarity. There's an entire podcast episode in itself about that. But what I would love you to just touch on is, people keep hearing about stable coins. We were involved in a bit of a discussion around stable coins this week. You made a really good point before we started this show about all stable coins are not equal. Could you give us your the personal opinions of Max, not those of your employer, but on just like important things that investigators and practitioners should understand about stable coins, and then maybe if we have time, also what the next big regulatory pushes are going to be. So again, I'm a civil tax, criminal tax investigator. What's CARF and what are these new reporting frameworks? What is that going to mean for me as a practitioner? If I can ask you on your view on those two things, that'd be super, super useful.
Yes. Maybe I tackle this from the back because it kind of ties in what I was talking with before. So right now, what we see is that bulk data assessments are really often one-off things because you subpoena information from an exchange via John Doe summons or a bulk data information request. You receive that, and then you need to work through it. So like these off-chain data sets up until now have just played a minor role in any financial crime investigation or in any law enforcement investigation, et cetera, even tax investigation. However, what we are seeing is that the OECD in end of 2023 agreed on an international standard that aligns financial reporting requirements of crypto asset service providers with those seen under banks. So in the banking space, a lot of people know about the CRS, which is the common reporting standards, and the equivalent for the US, which is FATCA, which basically, simply put, means service provider need to KYC their customers and collect their tax identification numbers and then report their transactions, like their behavior, to local tax administrations, right? So that they know what's going on in the space. Why is this now so relevant for crypto? Is because like from 1st of January 2026, every single service provider has to collect PII of their customers for tax identification purposes. Otherwise, for example, the European Union, they need to freeze accounts from performing transactions. That's a very, very big threat also for revenue generating business for the exchanges. So a lot of them are willing to comply with that, right? So they need to collect PII. They need to start tracking all the transactions across the exchanges. And by the end of the year, report this per account together with the PII, all the transactional activity in an aggregated format to the tax administration where they incorporated it. And why is this now so relevant? This is so relevant because it's not just applying to the European Union. Aidan, as you flagged, we like to regulate in the European Union, but no, it's a global standard. It's a global standard that applies across UK, Switzerland, European Union, but also Brazil, Uganda in Africa, for example. We have South Africa, we have Japan, we have Indonesia, we have Thailand. And now it gets interesting, we have the UAE, we have the Bahamas, we have the BVI, we have the Seychelles, we have Hong Kong, we have Singapore, we have everyone that is relevant that is being joining this reporting.
So the shady exchanges are getting driven more and more into the margins, because even if they don't have to register as a VASP or a virtual asset provider, they still have to provide information to the local tax authority.
Exactly, because these regimes, these OECD standards have an extraterritorial angle to them. So if you service people in a country, you need to still report on their transaction data. So I cannot just place myself outside of one of these 69 member states and then service people in these 69 member states. And this is why this has become so relevant. Now think about it. You won't catch the criminals with this, because most of them are not using the regulated exchanges, or like some of them are, so you will still get a lot of cases through that, but you won't catch the sophisticated criminals through this, let's say like that. There will always be a way to avoid it. However, what's going to happen is that right now tax transparency levels globally are anywhere between 0 and 10%, right? So we will see all of this information from all of these users being reported to local tax administrations that get flooded with all of these off-chain data sets that before always had to be subpoenaed, or where the law enforcement body would actually need to take action against an exchange and tell them, provide us data, and also justify why this data should be provided.
Which isn't a small, quick email, by the way. That's an enormous process for the agency. Yeah,
exactly. And now there's a statutory requirement from the service provider to provide this information to the authorities. So this will completely change the way how we think about how financial crime investigations are triggered. Because today, 95% of investigations are triggered usually by a Go AML report or some other AML report that initiates an investigation, right? Or like illicit on-chain activity. But because we have such high levels of tax non-compliance, this will trigger a lot of investigations based on the information that is received. Because by the rule of law, if you have PII that is collected to a clear case of non-compliance, you're required to do something with it, right? Start some investigation.
It sounds to me, again, as the... I can put myself back in my old shoes, and I can remember, you know, all investigators want a good case to investigate. And when you used to open a case, particularly, you know, I'm aggressively and happy to admit why wanting to go after the worst of society, and tax is usually the angle you can get them on. Again, I've been involved in child exploitation investigations, and you can't get them on the offense because of extraterritoriality, just sheer complexity, and just breaching that criminal standard. But it's like, you're an architect with a employment contract, but there's £100,000 in your bank account now, or from an exchange you cashed out with no explanation as to where that came from. I've got you for a non-disclosure of tax. In some countries, that's 10 or 20 years in prison, potentially. And so it sounds to me now, and I remember back in the days of like the offshore banking, when you'd get like the UBS data breach, when you got, or the famous disc, or you've got the Isle of Man, do you think that tax authorities are potentially, Max, going to go down some sort of route of amnesties? If I was back in HMRC, I'd be running a front page headline saying, we're getting all this information. If you live in the UK, you've got 3 months to come forward. We're not going to charge you a mega penalty. If when we play the bingo of what's on the form versus what's on your tax return, no, we'll go easy. Like, I can imagine this could potentially represent, and just, and obviously my mission in life is to move that sort of less than 1% asset recovery. This could be a huge shot in the arm for asset recovery in terms of like civil tax evasion.
Insane, right? And so this will bring a lot of like this is why I said like why solution like ours really bring a lot of ROI because it helps you to assess this data, structure it, and start an investigation, actually send a nudge letter to an individual to declare something, right? So yes, we see the jurisdictions moving into that, but I still feel that the overall weight, like, and the actual knowledge of the industry is very, very low because no one cared about taxes so far. It's really simple as that. But what we shouldn't forget is that this reporting regime is not about taxation. It's about closing the gap between on and off chain data and giving law enforcement bodies enable them to see what's going on. We like to think about it as a risk assessment tool, right?
Yeah, the tax evasion data is almost a second or secondary impact based on all this available information.
Exactly. And maybe now to the stablecoin question. I think this is a question that has been discussed quite a lot, right? When we talk about stablecoins, the biggest problem that we are facing today, from not just from the industry side, but also from a regulatory perspective, is the lack of common definitions. So I feel like when we talk about stablecoins, people throw different assets into the same bucket. And so there is a clear tendency of differentiating between true stablecoins that qualify as basically electronic money, and then those stablecoins that are crypto assets, after all, also because of the way they are backed and how their backing mechanism works. So basically, if we look at the European Union, there they have differentiated between electronic money tokens and asset reference tokens. And both applies to what is commonly known as a stablecoin. So an asset that would say, hey, we are $101, right? So both would be considered a stablecoin, but we need to look into it, what it actually is and what's the backing here. So in order to qualify as an electronic money, you would need to have like represent a claim on the issuer. Then you have an issuer on a receipt or is issued on receipt of fiat funds, right? The electronic money. It is accepted by third parties for payments. It is, and this is a very, very important point. It is redeemable at par value at any time, right? And it is issued under regulatory oversight. So in the European Union, you as an issuer, you would need to hold an electronic money institute license, an EMI license, in order to issue a true stablecoin. And why is this now so important? This is so important because there are certain stablecoins that are not this kind of electronic money and others that are, because those that are willing to spend a lot of money into transparency compliance, right? They're willing to give the financial market authorities the same information as banks would give to these financial market authorities. But the problem is then there's also issues of stablecoins that would not like to share this data for financial market authorities. And I'm not saying that all of the arguments that are being made not to share this information are wrong, right? Because often it's also a question of data protection. It's because it's on chain. So it's basically if you share this data with the authorities, you're like an open book. So there, it has its pros and its cons, but what we are seeing is that because certain stablecoin issues are not as much regulated as others, this could be to a certain extent then be taken advantage of for criminal purposes, right? And this is what we have seen also very recently in the latest updated guidance from the Financial Action Task Force that came out just like a couple of weeks ago, I think 2 weeks ago, where it really showed enormous amounts of stable coins being used for illicit activity.
Yeah, right? It's something we have discussed and debated, and everyone's discussed it. I think that it is important that we're fair to the industry. Obviously, I lean towards the asset recovery practitioner and the investigator in the room, but also as a startup ourselves. I mean, we've had to try and navigate the regulatory uncertainty about what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. It's why we made a choice to not service the public or retail or consumers to make it a bit more clear. So I completely can feel and respect the frustration that those good companies that just want to offer this technology and they can't get the regulatory clarity, so they can't build businesses because they want to make sure they're not going to get sued by a regulator in the future. Mm-hmm. But then I can also flip it that it must be so difficult for the regulators, because then they're stuck going, are they breaking the law or are they not? Or is it, I mean, it's so detailed, but I guess it's easy to get caught up in that discussion and lose sight of the fact that, like, when people say this is an important debate, then I often get, you know, rotten tomatoes thrown at me by the crypto bros. Like when they talk about, you know, privacy and government overreach, like if the system was all fine, we wouldn't be having these debates. We are not talking about, I mean, the honest guy that wants to move some stable coins because he wants to send money to his family in a foreign jurisdiction because of hyperinflation. We are talking about the people that are using this for money laundering, sanctions evasion, terrorist financing, drug networks. Like I think I'd said recently that in a quote that, I mean, all of the reasons that make stable coins in their various definitions amazingly interesting and attractive is the same reason it's attractive to criminals. Like, gold is a very useful asset. Criminals have it, so do non-criminals. I mean, cash. At one point, Pablo Escobar was one of the world's richest men. We had to come in and say, right, we need to fundamentally overhaul, you know, transactional data in regular fiat transactions. And I'm quoting Amanda Wick from her book launch the other week, where she said, you know, sometimes it takes something the scale of 9/11 to make everybody go, okay, we really got to put the privacy bit has to be a consideration, but the global goods and like national security has to be the leading sort of reason. I mean, if you were sort of guessing from what you're seeing, like, what do you think? How do you think this is all going to land in terms of the stable coin piece? Is it going to be a mass exodus from the EU? Everyone now is going to go to the US because, you know, the US is blue sky for the next 4 years, it looks like. Or how do you think this is going to sort of all unpack?
Oh, this is such a difficult question because there's so many nuances to that. I feel like one of the things that one should also keep in mind that it's not always related also to the stablecoin issuer themselves, but also for the exchanges that then would swap it against fiat, or like that would accept it for a means of payment, right?
Yeah, there's a ton of actors involved
Exactly, because I mean, like, ultimately the question also, for example, Monero, right? You had privacy coins that were being used for illicit purposes quite a bit, but at the same time, they also served another privacy concerning aspect, right? That was positive. So I feel like at this point,
I was listening to, I have to give credit here, I think it was Emma Henshaw at TRM giving a talk. Was Monero is going to go through? Is it going through a big upgrade at the end of the year or next year, where it's actually going to get even harder to trace? You know, from a law enforcement perspective, it almost feels to me like the battle lines are being drawn a little bit. It's like, you know, based on the jurisdiction you set up in, the tokens you list are the way you want to go. But then again, taking it back to the theme of this podcast, this is not new. This has always happened. People have always smuggled gold and diamonds and artwork and laundered through real estate. I mean, are we just seeing history will just repeat itself with the latest technology?
I think so. So and the biggest issue that we are facing right now is, after all, crypto is borderless by design. Right. We have a regulatory race to the bottom with certain jurisdictions that want to attract a lot of players for obvious reasons, because it boosts their economy, right? It boosts their standard of living. So why wouldn't they not like want these players to settle in their countries? So there is a race to the bottom. At the same time, we have borderless technology that allows it to serve users across the globe instantly. Right. So this is becoming more and more of a challenge. Where this whole thing goes, I don't even think like that these players that really want to avoid law and want to avoid regulation would go to the United States, because after all, I mean, even the US is now agreed on its Genius Act, right? So we are seeing also in the area of stablecoins regulation kicking in. But what I'm seeing is, yeah, stablecoins are a means of transferring value. They are seen as a very low risk value transfer method, not just for the industry, but of course also for criminals, because they are stable, right? At least that's what some of them claim. And after all, this is what criminals are interested in as well, because no one wants to sit on the volatility of Bitcoin. going up and down and not knowing if when you pay the next one in the food chain, so to say, that you give them the right amount of money in order
to... You couldn't possibly see suggesting that people like cartels or would be upset with people at losing their money. What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly.
I think we've naturally come full circle, and I hope I don't speak for you, but I do think we agree that, I mean, this is not new. I mean, from your background, from my background, there's always going to be the new thing. I think we have hit, one could argue that, yes, we're in a true, it's the speed has changed, because smuggling gold is borderless if you go through the country that has the worst customs control. Like, there's always weak links in all global ecosystems. I think it's the scale and potential, and you've highlighted the scale and potential of data. But now the challenge is, how do you be efficient with that data? How do you build these cases, and how do you also, you know, comply? And I think what's super exciting is, you know, what does the next sort of 3, 6, 9, 12 months look like, and what's going to change with the sort of the global reporting? Max, I would like to, I ask everyone the same sort of question with our asset recovery practitioner audience in mind. Like, what's the advice? What's the, having a coffee at a conference, having a beer, having a glass of wine with somebody, you're saying to somebody, like, if you can give them that rallying cry going forward, bar just, you know, hang in there and keep your head, because, you know, law enforcement and practitioners have such a difficult job.
Yeah.
Is it a message of, you know, optimism? Because actually, things are about to get really, really interesting. Or what wise words would you give to them for us to conclude on?
I think it's optimism, honestly, because I feel like that especially the field that we have been operating in is still quite niche, right? So also there was not a lot of budget that was dedicated to the area that we are operating in. Now governments are starting to realize that trillions of dollars are being transferred. They are starting to acknowledge, hey, we actually need to also enable our authorities to be able to cope with this, right? What we are seeing is that also the off-chain data problem will help a lot in the investigation work, because you actually get more data than you had before, because right now it's always been a black box, as I said. So there is a certain degree of optimism as well. I mean,
on the other hand,
I mean, you have AI agents that are now also being used by criminals, right? So AI is going to scale also criminal behavior in a certain way. No one has seen it before. So I think this is worrying and definitely something to be prepared for. From my own perspective, I always like to think in steps, because you cannot think in, oh, what's going to happen in 10 years, in five, even 5 years in our space. I feel like you would just like be mentally drained and be like, oh my God, how are we ever going to cope with this? So I like your approach of thinking like 6 months, 12 months. I think that the information reporting thing will change quite a lot. I think that the capability of actually dealing with bulk data sets and framing it down for increased efficiency in case management will lead to more cases solved, right? Ultimately also to more seizures and more asset recovery. So I feel that there is definitely some good movement, and we are keeping up with it. It's difficult, right? But also industry is keeping up with it. And I feel like as long as we continue having these discussions always between private and public sector, because ultimately it is a joint effort, we will keep up to speed.
Max, that's a brilliant point to end on. I like to remind people that digital assets presents new threats, new opportunities, but let's also be realistic. We have been attempting to tackle traditional money laundering now for decades. Yes. Billions has been spent globally, yet still trillions are laundered every single year. So a dose of reality, but an ending on a point of optimism that actually now we have a chance to have data, that it's not just going after one case. I like your point about the potential ROI, that, you know, combining data and looking at this a bit more holistically, it's not just, I got one bad guy, shut down one case, shut down one network. You're then feeding the machine that creates momentum that, and hopefully then that leads to better political outcomes, which we know is what drives more and, you know, more budgets going back into law enforcement. Someone somewhere has to stand and sort of celebrate and be on the front of the press. Exactly. Max, we'll wrap up there. I think we'll pencil this in for 12 months' time, and hopefully we're talking about all these global success stories and amazing tax evasion.
We will.
Max, thank you so much for your time today. I thought this would be 20 minutes, and I knew it would never be 20 minutes with you and me talking. So I'm grateful that we've been able to.
Thank you very much, Aidan. It was a pleasure to talk to you, like always. Thank you very much.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.